Okay, folks, we'll begin here. Until we get a quorum, we'll hold off on the formal acceptance of the notes. And Public Safety Policy and Finance Committee is pleased to announce the presence of law enforcement today to give us a presentation. If those folks representing law enforcement to come up to the table, we're probably ready to begin. Whoever would like to start first.
You bet. Well, anybody, actually. I mean, we just wanted to get the law enforcement first so we could get them back on the street fighting crime.
All right. Come on up, Chief.
Chief Ramsey, is it?
Yes, sir, Chairman Cornish.
You both know my kid, Gabe Cornish. Yes. He used to work up in Duluth on the freeway there. So.
You should be proud of him.
Yeah. Good to what's that? Why don't you go ahead with your presentation.
Chairman Cornish and representatives, my name is Gordon Ramsey. I'm the police chief in Duluth, and I also am a board member on the Minnesota Chiefs of Police and the legislative co-chair, and I represent them as well today. Regarding task force, violent offender task force, drug task force, they're throughout the state. They cover every corner of the state. Just about probably every jurisdiction in here is represented by one of the task forces. If you look at the crime figures in your area that you represent, I'm sure the sheriff or the chief would tell you that the majority of property crimes and likely the majority of violent crimes are somehow drug-related. Recently in my area, we had a double homicide in Carlton County, their first in many years. That was drug related, and our task force was a big part of that investigation and bringing that to an end. Our property crimes in Duluth, we have 7,000 to 8,000 a year. The majority of those are also drug related. So really in Minnesota, I say that, and I'm sure that the majority of my colleagues would agree that drugs drive our crime rate. The latest trend with prescription drugs is also becoming a major issue, which our task forces have been a part of, as well as throughout the state. Several Indian reservations have declared a health emergency related to the issue of prescription drugs. You want me to continue, Chair? I'm sorry if I just started ahead. You want me to just start?
You get.
Okay.
Go ahead.
All right.
Well, I suppose we could interject this time now that we've got a quorum and bring the meeting to formal order and start out with a roll call.
Cornish.
Here.
Mullery. Gauthier.
Here.
Grunhagen.
Here.
Johnson.
Here.
Kelly.
Here.
Kiefer.
Here.
Leidiger.
Here.
Mariani. McDonald, Moran,
here.
Nornis,
here.
Slocum, Smith,
here.
Okay, and if somebody would move the minutes,
so moved.
Representative Kelly moves the minutes from March 10th. Any additions or corrections? Seeing none, all in favor, say aye.
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 Opposed? Okay, minutes approved. Back to the chief, and during your testimony, both of you, would you tell us during that what a cut would 25% or 50% or elimination of the forces, what would that do? How would it affect your mission specifically? What wouldn't you be able to do? Thank you.
Mr. Chair, so as I continue then, as I mentioned, the majority of our property crimes and violent crimes are connected to drugs, so any cut to our task force, which is about $310,000, would be substantial. It means bodies. Of that money that we're funded by, none of it is we use for equipment. It is entirely for salaries. After dark, in many of our communities, our police calls are driven by drugs or alcohol, or the people that we deal with are either on drugs or alcohol, or victims of those who are on drugs or alcohol. The task forces that we have in the state work very well together. Our task force was recently down in the St. Cloud area, assisting them with some connection of crack cocaine dealing that was occurring in both of our communities, the same people involved. As well as those that are using the drugs, we have many one-person crime waves that affect our crimes in our community substantially. That was just a little thumbnail sketch of what drugs does in our community, how it drives our crime, and this task force, our task forces are very important in addressing those issues. Substantial arrests have been made every, quarterly we review our statistics. They're arresting those that are out there habitually offending, victimizing our citizens. We're getting guns off the street. If you look at our robberies, the majority of our robberies in Duluth, and we've been upwards of 100 the last several years, the majority of those are drug ripoffs. And those business robberies almost always have a drug connection as well. And I'll wrap it up with that.
Perfect.
Sheriff, you'd like to go ahead.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, members, thank you. My name is Rich Stanek, Kanapa County Sheriff. It's a distinct pleasure, Mr. Chair, members, to be back here with you. The way we, from law enforcement, wanted to set this up this morning was talk to you a little bit from a greater Minnesota perspective with Chief Ramsey in the Duluth area, with Dakota County Attorney, and I'm not sure if he was able to join us yet, but he's on his way, if not, and myself from Hennepin County, kind of a metro area perspective. We appreciate you putting this on the agenda today and allowing Chief and others to get back on the streets and get the work done that you expect from us. You know, the Office of Justice programs are important to the public safety in this state, without a doubt. And in the wake of the failed Metro Gang Strike Force, state and local law enforcement agencies merged narcotics task forces and gang task forces into violent crime enforcement teams with oversight by the Violent Crimes Coordinating Council. A lot of that was done this past legislative session. These multi-jurisdictional task forces work across boundaries to address the most violent repeat offenders. And in Hennepin County, a county with about 1.2 million residents, 22% of our state's population, and no less than 46% of the state's violent crime, the murder, the rape, the robbery, the aggravated assault, we rely on the OJP funding in order to help fund our local task forces. Five multi-jurisdictional task forces operate throughout Hennepin County. And Mr. Chair, members, I have a map of how those task forces are split up in Hennepin County, if you so wish. Sandra has it for you, and she can give it to your community administrator clerk to hand it out. Sandra, you got that? Mr. Chair, members, of these five task forces, three of them receive some state funds through the VSED grants or the Violent Crime Enforcement Team grants. These three are the Minneapolis Safe Streets Task Force, Northwest Metro Task Force, and the Hennepin County Violent Offenders Task Force. The Southwest and West Metro Task Forces receive no state funds and are funded primarily through forfeitures, which actually is a contrary to a key recommendation of the State Auditor's Report on the Metro Gang Strike Force. That report recommended that task forces should not rely on forfeitures for operations, which is another reason why the state funding through the Office of Justice programs is so important to us. Northwest Metro, which is supervised by the Plymouth Police Department, received $90,000 in 2010 and decreased to $44,550 for the first half of 2011. Safe Streets, if you don't know much about it, members, is a federal initiative sponsored by the FBI targeting gangs in Minneapolis and St. Paul. It was intended to be fully funded by the feds when it began, about $400,000 per year in state VSET funding is now used to support this federal effort, which somewhat defeats the initial intent of the feds helping fund local law enforcement. And of the five task forces in Hennepin County, the one that we command and we supervise and oversee the fiscal responsibilities of it is the Hennepin County Violent Offender Task Force. Our votive team is comprised of officers and deputies from Hennepin County Sheriff's Office, Brooklyn Park Police Department, Brooklyn Center Police Department, Golden Valley Police Department, the Richfield Police Department, and the Drug Enforcement Administration. In 2010, our Violent Offender Task Force received $470,000 in Violent Crime Enforcement Team grants. This funding goes to the partner agencies to help offset their costs in assigning their full-time personnel to the task force. Approximately $30,000 per officer then is reimbursed to those local agencies to offset the officer's salary. Probably the same for Chief Ramsey and his task forces and the others that operate across the state. In 2011, Mr. Chair and members, the first 6 months' grant funding was $229,000, or a 2.5% reduction from last year's grant funding at this time. Our Violent Offender Task Force abides by the best practices set forth by the state's Department of Public Safety, specific to the handling of property and evidence, forfeitures, and informant files. We actually wrote the policies and provided them to the state, many of which were adopted. And Mr. Chair, members, the results, as Chief Ramsey laid out, are undeniable. In 2010, just alone, the Hennepin County Violent Offender Task Force confiscated 88 firearms and made 190 arrests. 61 of those were state charges, 22 of them federal charges. The 190 arrests made by this votive team, with multiple felony arrests for crimes of violence. And, Mr. Chair, members, it does make a difference in violent crime. Chief Ramsey and County Attorney Baxton would tell you the same, as well as any of your local police chiefs or sheriffs in your individual districts. Over the past 4 years, violent crime in Hennepin County has been reduced by 32%. A large part of that, honestly, is in concert with our local law enforcement agencies working in this task force environment across jurisdictional boundaries. We all know, as the Chief pointed out, that bad guys and a lot of more bad women these days cross over jurisdictional boundaries, and they don't know any specific boundaries when they do their crimes. And so our agencies work in collaboration together through a task force environment in order to get the job done. And yes, on occasion we do need funding assistance to do that, and OJP has stepped up and provided that necessary funding for us. Really, Mr. Chair, to get to the heart of your question, which is, you know, what are we going to see if there's a reduction in OJP funds specifically for the law enforcement side? 25, 50, or 100% reduction would be detrimental to law enforcement operations in this task force environment. As it stands now, many agencies choose not to participate because the funding is so little. They'd rather just be fairly narrow-minded and work on the crime in their individual cities or counties. But we all know, again, that this crime is multi-jurisdictional. They know no boundaries, and so we get a surge factor of value-added policing by forming task forces in order to go after these folks. The results statewide, and I think those numbers are available to you from the Department of Public Safety Office of Justice programs, are tremendous. So, Mr. Chair, members, we understand, you know, where the state's at. We understand that you're taking a look at OJP funding as a whole. But when you get down to it, to the law enforcement grants that fund our operations or partially our operations, we want you to know that we do care. We want you to know that we're going to continue to be there. We'll provide, I think, the results that you expect from us in local law enforcement, kind of performance-based measures or outcomes. With that, Mr. Chair, I'm sure myself and Chief Ramsey, I'm not sure if the county attorney is able to join us. Yeah? No? If not, the Chief and I would be happy to answer any questions you might have about our specific piece of the Office of Justice Program grants.
Well, thank you, Sheriff. Neither you or the Chief can answer this, but what have you heard as far as your legislative liaisons in Washington as far as the future of funding federally, like in grants coming from them? Are any of them applicable for you, or have you heard much about that, what it might be like?
Mr. Chair, members, unless you want to answer this question.
Go ahead, you start.
Sandra Westman does our government relations on behalf of the Sheriff's Office, and she advised, she had a conference call on Friday afternoon with major county sheriffs, major county chiefs, other large law enforcement operations across the country. As yet, Congress has not broken down by individual program the reductions that they'll be making, particularly to burn JAG funding, which, as you know, flow into the state of Minnesota and then directly back out to local law enforcement.
And then, Sheriff or Chief, what are you able to keep the items that you seize and sell, and is that amount to much of anything as far as being able to operate your individual task force, or where do those proceeds have to go, the confiscated property or cash or guns?
Mr. Chair, there are different percentages. A certain amount goes back to the county attorney's office, crime victims. So it's dependent on how we charge it, if we charge it state or federally, is one way that's determined. The other way, those are the two ways that it's determined. But generally, they do go back and help with the operational costs of the task forces. The forfeiture money, in our case, pays for the cell phones of our officers that we wouldn't otherwise be able to afford. Additionally, Mr. Chair, if I may answer that question on the federal grant portion, we currently have a funded position for a crime analyst that was funded by the feds 2 years ago. The senator's office, the U.S. senator's office, tells us that that will be ending, as well as several, we had been lobbying for several appropriations to further bolster our task force. That, and obviously all appropriations have been canceled as of the last year.
Another one of our...
Mr. Chair, members, if I might, two things. Mm-hmm. One, there's a number of task forces that have Department of Defense personnel or National Guard. Is that what you're referring to, Chief?
That National Guard. Well, this was an appropriation, but we also had a National Guard analyst as well.
Now, many of us had folks from the National Guard assigned to our task forces or our operations to help with analysis, and those have all been taken away as a result of funding cuts to the Department of Defense. Specifically, though, you asked about forfeitures and how they, you know, what happens with that when they come back to the task forces. I think, Mr. Chair, members, what you don't want to get into the situation of these task forces, if they're going to be in operation, that they rely on the funding of forfeitures or seized property to fund their operations. That was one of the key findings from the State Auditor's Report as they presented it to you last year in the wake of the failed Metro Gang Strike Force, and that's what we in law enforcement want to avoid, which is why, again, one of the reasons why the Office of Justice Programs and state funding to offset the officer salaries is so important to us.
And I think it should be noted that the hoopla and the all the attention that the wrongful actions got last year or two from the Gang Strike Force didn't really apply to the greater Minnesota, the other Drugger Task Force, and just something to keep in mind that was pretty much located within that unit. We have Representative Mullery, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Sheriff, this thing you handed out, it says Twin Cities FBI Violent Gang Task Force, and then said federal burn funding. I thought federal burn went to state or and then to locals. Why is the FBI task force funded by that and not by the feds directly?
Sheriff?
No, that's a great question, Mr. Chair and Representative Mullery. I would defer that question, though, to the Department of Public Safety Office of Justice Programs to answer. They oversee how those funding grants are allocated and to whom.
Okay, Representative Mullery, we'll remember that one when Ms. Bovier comes up from OJP. Representative Leidiger.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. Sheriff, I'm just a little bit unclear about the funding for the task forces. Does it all come out of the OJP, or do you have some allocation that comes from your normal funding through public safety?
Sheriff?
Mr. Chair, members, and Representative Leidiger, we receive, at least in terms of Hennepin County, we receive partial funding through the Office of Justice Programs, these violent crime enforcement team grants. The rest of the operations, though, by and large, the vast majority come from our the Hennepin County Sheriff's Office or the taxpayers of Hennepin County to fund our operations, or the City of Plymouth or City of Robbinsdale or Golden Valley, whatever city participates in that collaborative task force. Those salaries are primarily paid by the individual city or their city's property taxes.
Can I follow up? Then, so what percentage of the overall funding for the special task forces come from the OJP funds?
Sheriff or Chief?
Approximately.
Mr. Chair, Representative Leiniger, we are about a third. We're funded at $310,000 through OJP, and our budget for our task force is around $900,000.
Okay.
And I imagine that would task force that would vary depending on how much
correct
everybody puts in.
But across the board, it's about a third. I mean, on each task force.
Jerry Bovier is saying yes.
Okay. Thanks, sir. Yes. Okay, Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Sheriff Stank, when I look at the multi-jurisdictional task forces, I see it's all Hennepin County. Does it also multi-jurisdictional from Hennepin to Ramsey to Inopa and so forth, or is it all encased in one county? Can you tell me a little bit about how that works?
Sure.
Mm-hmm.
Hey, Mr. Chair, members, and Representative Johnson, what I gave you is just a snapshot of task forces operating within Hennepin County's boundaries. There's actually 24 task forces that operate across the state under supervision of Department of Public Safety, and that's where those grant monies come from. Six of them that operate within Hennepin County, three of them receive some type of state funding, three of them do not. And then you've got how many?
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So would Ramsey County have a similar profile then that to what I'm looking at here?
Hey, Mr. Sure. Chair, members, Representative Johnson, that's correct. Ramsey County would have a similar profile. I'm not sure how many task forces they have operating within their county. And then I asked the chief how many has up in the arrow.
Chief?
Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, we have two, the Boundary Waters Task Force, as well as the Lake Superior Drug and Gang Task Force, which takes about 16 individuals. Statewide, we have over 200 investigators under the task forces coming from 120 different agencies.
Okay, thank you, Chief. Sheriff or Chief, if you can answer this, it can have Ms. Bovier when she comes up, but how many different titles do we have? Now, we got violent offender, we got drug task force, we got gang strike force. How many different titles of these and different organizations would there be? Is it quite a variance there, but basically related to those subjects?
Mr. Chair, obviously there was some vernacular changes this year in what they're termed. We are in Duluth, it's the Lake Superior Violent Offenders Task Force that is funded. And it also, it's the formerly known as Lake Superior Drug and Gang. Jerry Bovier, I'm sure, can answer that.
No, regardless of the title, Chief or Sheriff, do you engage in activities with, so just say if it's got one name, do you take care of gangs, drugs, violent crime, all three of them with that task force then?
Mr. Chair, yes, that is the case. They do drug investigations. They assist us with violent crime investigations when there's that nexus to drugs and gangs.
Okay, yeah, Mr. Chair, members, yeah, I think sure. Each area has, or each part of the state, each task force has the same nexus, which is narcotics and gangs. In Hennepin County, we choose to focus on violent offenders based on their criminal history with a nexus to gang or narcotics. Some parts of the state with their task forces focus on narcotics, some on gangs, some a combination of the two. Really depends on what kind of problems they're having, I guess, in terms of crime within their local area.
Either one of you, do both of you try to keep as many feet on the street as possible? In other words, what we hate to see at the legislature is a lot of button pushers or keyboard operators when we talk about law enforcement money. Do you make an effort to keep as low administration as possible and put the money on the street?
Mr. Chair, absolutely. That's our philosophy, and it shows if you look at least in our agency's case, how we compare as far as other organizations nationwide, we're very flat, and the focus is on that being out there visible on the street and proactively dealing with these cases.
Before I get chastised, I should never use the word hate, I suppose. Politically, but would be dislike. So that's some of our concern nationally. And then the other thing is, what are you able to spend your funds on? Are you able to spend it on salaries, equipment? If it is equipment, what would be some of the equipment you might get with that money?
Mr. Chair, members, in Hennepin County, we use ours for salary offsets. So again, if the city of Golden Valley has a police officer assigned, their base salary plus fringe and whatever else comes up to $75,000 to $80,000, this $30,000 would offset that officer's salary back to the local jurisdiction. So a hard cost like lease, cell phones, vehicles, equipment, that's what we fund through forfeiture seizures or a direct appropriation from the sheriff's office. Again, each jurisdiction or task force might be slightly different. That's how we do it in Hennepin County.
Do you try to take care of the training on your own budgets instead of the task force money?
Sure, Mr. Chair, members, the majority of the training specific to gang and narcotics enforcement would come from these monies, the state monies. Generalized training that a law enforcement or peace officer needs in order to maintain his or her license would come out of the agency's allocation.
Representative Gauthier.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Chief Ramsey, you had said that the allocation is $310,000 for the Duluth Task Force. How many officers are involved in that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Gauthier, we have 10 with Lake Superior.
So if we're looking at a 25% cut, which is about $77,000, how would that affect the task force?
Mr. Chair, Councilor, or Representative Gauthier, formerly Councilor Gauthier, we have, that would probably be two positions. As we talked about, all that state money right now goes to salary, the training costs in our organization and equipment costs are absorbed by our agencies that are involved in this task force.
Mr. Chair, Chief Ramsey, So if we take two positions out of 10, 20% cut, what does that do for effectiveness?
Mr. Chair, Representative Gauthier, currently in our agency, we are holding open about 12 positions, which is that's major on operations for our department. We're at the point now where there's certain crimes that we're not able to investigate because we're holding these positions open. The connection to the drug and violent crime world, this would have an impact that would be concerning to me.
Okay, thank you, Chief.
Mr. Chair, members, perspective of a larger sheriff's office, we reduced 42 FTEs this year in 2011. So we've already reduced 42 FTEs in our agency. What we use the state's money for is to help the local agencies form their collaborative partnership across multi-jurisdictional boundaries. So a reduction in funds for the violent crime enforcement team in Hennepin County would mean the most likely that those local agencies would no longer be able to participate, which would defeat the purpose of a multi-jurisdictional task force.
Representative Mullery.
Well, Mr. Chair, you were asking about use of the forfeiture. Under Minnesota law, as we learned last year, it's not supposed to be used for the salaries. It can be used for other equipment, for the task forces. It can technically be used for things like pension or non-expected overtime, things like that, but it's not supposed to be used for the salary. So we can't take money away from their salaries and then plug it with forfeiture.
Okay, Representative Leidiger.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Sheriff, I'm kind of familiar with task forces in the Department of Defense, and usually has been created in the past as a temporary organization to accomplish a specific task. That's the reason why we have those. My question is, are we in an era where we're seeing that that these task forces are created and this is going to be more of a normal way of policing, of ensuring public safety in the future? Do you believe that this is the way that we're going? Should we be funding this at a greater level, perhaps at the expense of, you know, overall other kinds of departmental funding? I'm trying to get a sense of what you see in task force policing in the future.
Sheriff or Chief?
Sure. Well, Mr. Chair, members, Representative Leidiger, and I'll take the first whack at it. My, you know, experience over the years, task forces are the way to do policing. A lot different today than it was maybe just 10 years ago. I think you see the lines of jurisdiction between local, state, county, federal law enforcement agencies blurred. Before, these be very distinct, and that was okay. We liked it that way. Now we've come to realize that the sharing of information across jurisdictional boundaries is to everybody's advantage in law enforcement in order to reduce crime. And I can tell you sincerely, over the last 4 years, 5 years in Hennepin County, because we've worked across jurisdictional boundaries, I've got no less than 47 cities, 37 local police departments, including the sheriff's office, operating within the boundaries of Hennepin County, but we work collaboratively every day. And through our six task forces that focus on these violent crimes, gangs and narcotics, we're much better off. Back in 05 and 06, violent crime in my county went up 15% each year. 05 and 06, 15%. And over the last 4 years, by working together with the local agencies, forming task force partnerships, getting more bang for the buck, so to speak, or value-added policing, we've been able to reduce crime by 32%. The numbers themselves are undeniable, but really I think what you want to get at, Representative, is, you know, is task force concept within law enforcement something that's of age and that we're using every day? And the answer is absolutely yes, whether it's my agency down here in Hennepin County, whether it's southern Minnesota, you get up to northern Minnesota where the chief is, and he'll tell you the same thing. We rely on the task forces to get the job done, where individual agencies may not be in a position to be able to do it today because of the mobility of crime.
Mr. Chair, Representative, if I can just take a quick stab at that as well. The where I see the task forces are successful is that we share in expenses. So it's not just our city buying something and other cities around us or other members of our task force. So we buy one piece of equipment and we share it amongst others. We share other costs. We share the expertise associated with the different people in the task forces. So they travel around our task force area. And it improves communication among the different departments that are involved. Those are the biggies for me that I see why the task forces, that model works for us.
The only follow-up then that I would have is the funding of this. It sounds as though this is, and it sounds like it's an efficient way to do it. It sounds like the task at hand is not going to diminish over time. So does that mean funding in this area, you know, of course, we're in an era of not having all the funding we'd like. Do you put more? Does each department put more resources in the task initiative? Do you believe that that's the route that you're going to end up taking?
Sheriff.
Mr. Chair, members, Representative Leidiger, let me just say it like this. Again, through multi-jurisdictional task forces, we can cross over geographical boundaries, band together, right, provide that regionalization of police services, which is good government and cost-effective, as the Chief pointed out, across the board. And the state's funding provides about one-third of an officer's salary. The local city or jurisdiction pays the other two-thirds. You come down to a breaking point, though, at which point then does the city continue to participate in a task force environment, or do they just keep their officer or deputy sheriff back home in their home jurisdiction? When they stay back home, they're like this. They stay within the geographical boundaries of that city or that county. That's not good to reduce violent crime on a regional basis or a statewide basis. You want the officers and the deputies to work in these partnerships with their agencies across geographical boundaries.
Thank you.
Well, Sheriff or Chief, what's the level of paperwork like? And maybe Ms. Westerman could answer it too, but how much accountability do you have to, is it quite a hassle or is it medium or heavy, the amount of return paperwork you have to give in return for the funding?
Mr. Chair, obviously every unit in the police department and under government is under the gun as far as where their expenses are going. Our task force documents everything they do, put into an annual report with the statistics readily available to the public. In addition to just the statistics keeping, there's also the, as you're aware, the normal everyday reports and portions that go with that.
Okay, Representative Grunhagen, followed by Gauthier.
Hey, thank you, Mr. Chair. Testifier, Sheriff Stanek. I got a question probably from a little different perspective. To what degree, and I don't know if you can voice an answer on this or not, but to what degree do you think that the way we administer our welfare programs contributes to the breakdown of the family and ultimately to a climate of higher crime Because we all know that if our policies here at the state would reinforce the husband-wife traditional family, that's good economically, it's better for the children long-term, and it it creates a lot of other economic benefits. You deal with the, you know, I notice Hennepin County, 46% of the total number of violent crimes in the state of Minnesota. I also know that our Medicaid funds, about 53% of them, I believe, are being spent in Hennepin and Ramsey County. So, I mean, it seems we're putting a tremendous amount of government money into these counties, and yet I'm just wondering, do you see that the policies of our welfare program actually undermine the family and contribute to a climate where you have a higher incidence of alcohol, drug abuse, and ultimately criminal behavior? Any thoughts?
Sheriff or Chief, with either one, you'd like to comment about our welfare program?
Mr. Chair, I'll defer to Chief Ramsey.
Okay, Chief.
Well, I don't know, Mr. Chair, members, that either one of us be in a position today to answer a question like that. We appreciate the question. We understand the concerns by the committee. Maybe we can talk about it offline. I'm happy to stop by and visit you, though.
Okay, I appreciate that. The reason is, you know, according to the Heritage Foundation, we've spent $15 trillion in this country since the 60s to bring people out of poverty, and our poverty rate is about the same or worse than we started, and the criminal element seems to be getting worse in most cases rather than better. So all this money's being spent, but actually I think it's, in many cases, I'm beginning to draw the conclusion that it undermines the family, it contributes to a climate of alcohol and drug abuse, and ultimately it's regressive in terms of the things we actually want to accomplish. So I would appreciate your perspective on that if you want to stop by and make an appointment with my LA. Okay, thank you.
Representative Gauthier.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Chief Sheriff. My question is, obviously we have the I-35 corridor north-south to Duluth and Minneapolis-St. Paul. How do these task force work statewide with each other? I think that's part of the puzzle that we're missing this morning.
Mr. Chair, Representative Gauthier, as I hit on a little bit, we've recently been working a fair amount with the St. Cloud Task Force on some crack cocaine cases. Throughout the state, these task forces build relationships. They share knowledge. I called our commander of our task force as I was driving down here today, and he said that was one of the important factors that he finds valuable in the task force, is that the level of communication, these officers all get to know each other because they are, you know, everybody's crisscrossing, and they know their peers by name across the state and their phone numbers, and they've talked frequently about what they're seeing and as far as working together, how they can work better together. But no doubt that is a very large part of these task forces.
Mr. Chair, members, representatives, specifically in the metro area, we've got a number of these 24 different task forces working across, like I said, the jurisdictional boundaries. Hennepin County Sheriff's Office meets regularly once a week with Anoka County and the Ramsey County task forces and the county attorneys from those respective jurisdictions so that we can better coordinate our both enforcement efforts as well as share information across those geographic boundaries. And we do have, Mr. Chair, members, I think you touched on something just briefly about deconfliction. You wonder how all these task forces work together. In the state of Minnesota, we do have a deconfliction system. And so when the chief up here in Duluth is working on a case and we've got something down here in Hennepin County or Ramsey, Anoka, Carver, wherever, we have a means by which we understand where each other is going, maybe what target or individual we are working on, so that we don't waste our resources or, in our cases, create an officer safety issue in terms of working the same subject, maybe the same residents, maybe the same pipeline of drugs or gangs, whatever it might be.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Guthrie.
Well, my point being is this isn't just isolated to metro areas. It's a statewide problem. and requires a statewide response.
Okay, Representative Kelly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess to go along with Representative Leidiger's question, if this is going to be kind of our mode of operation now, how we conduct business, I guess one of my questions, and Mr. Chair, maybe this is what you're getting at, the bureaucracy that it takes from OJP to get the funding, actually, not how you monitor the task force itself, but just the transfer of dollars to do the programming. Maybe the idea is we fund it directly to the departments, and it's within your departments, as opposed to going through OJP and relieving that just that transaction.
Chief or Sheriff?
Mr. Chair, Representative Kelly, that's something that I have not given a lot of thought to. There is value funneling it through OJP. They ensure that the standards are that we meet certain standards. They also offer some technical support. They've helped us out with a lot of issues from evidence retention, how to handle the money that otherwise, particularly in the last several years, that we might not have had that expertise at that level. So OJP does offer us some resources associated with this task force that I find very valuable for overall operations.
Mr. Chair, members, County Attorney Backstrom is here if you wish to hear from him as well. He was kind of the third part of our presentation.
Is this on this question? I think Representative Kelly had another question. Representative Kelly?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess just along with the lines of total operation, currently have 24 task forces, I believe. In your opinion, is that too many? Can we consolidate it? Can we get it down to a more suitable number that would still have that, be able to cross jurisdictions and be able to operate a little more efficiently?
Chair for Chief.
Mr. Chair, members, Representative Johnson, I don't know what the optimal number is. We've 22, 24, 26, maybe less. I know within my county we operate five of them, and then there's one that crosses over between Anoka and Hennepin. The cities of Champlin and Maple Grove participate in the Anoka County Task Force. I think when you get four or five or six local communities banded together, you're talking about a geographical area in terms of travel and distance, maybe not so great down here in the metro piece, but mileage is an issue up here with my friend in the northern part of the state. When you get down to the metro area, though, I've got a problem with population density. I've got 1.2 million folks and five task forces operating. That's a pretty good chunk of the state's population and the state's violent crime. So we think we operate pretty efficiently. We don't plan on adding any additional ones, but rather enhancing the ones that we do have down here in the metro area.
Representative Nornes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a quick question. I guess I'm curious to know whether you're seeing any progress in the war against either gangs or drugs, and then how do you deal with the frustration of the officers that seem to be just kind of chasing the I mean, I guess that goes to the first question. Are you seeing where we're getting a handle or making any progress in these areas? Is there less or more?
Sure, Chief.
Sure. Mr. Chair, members, and Representative Nornes, from my perspective, again, I know it's centric to the metro area, but if you take just Hennepin County itself, just 4 or 5 years ago, Hennepin County was 60%, 22% of the state's population, but 60% of the state's violent crime. We're still 22% of the state's population, but now we're down to 44% of the state's violent crime. That's a significant reduction in terms of thousands of less victims of rape, robbery, murder, aggravated assault. So we think we're making very good progress, given the economy, giving strapped resources with local law enforcement agencies, even questions that you're asking, here this morning. Now, we think we're making pretty good headway, but the folks we're seeing are getting more violent. Violent crime might be going down, but the folks that we are seeing are more violent than ever before, and I know the county attorney has a comment on that because he sees them every day when they come across his desk for charging.
Thank you.
Okay,
Mr. Chair,
Backstrom, if we could have you address this, and then keep in mind that we
we've got a pretty good presentation from law enforcement's perspective and the importance of it. We'd like to see it from your perspective and how many good cases maybe came to you that normally wouldn't without the task forces and how important it is.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. James Backstrom, Dakota County Attorney. I apologize for being a little late this morning. This is an extremely important issue. I want to lend the support of prosecutors across our state, the Minnesota County Attorneys Association, to the continued funding of our drug task forces. These task forces are essential to keeping our communities safe. I want to just give you a quick review about, you know, the number of cases generated in my community in response to your question, Mr. Chair. Last year, the Dakota County Drug Task Force consists of all 11 Dakota County law enforcement agencies and the city of Savage in our neighboring Scott County conducted over 550 investigations last year into the illegal distribution or possession of drugs, resulting in 591 individuals being charged with felony-level offenses and another 103 being charged with non-drug-related cases. So these cases do generate investigation. The investigations of these drug crimes generate our ability to prosecute other offenses as well in our communities. Domestic violence, for one prime example of situations that we investigate. Keeping in perspective, you know, 591 individuals charged in Dakota County with felony offenses related to illegal drug use. That's out of 1,465 total felony charges that we filed in our state, the third largest county in our state last year, involving felony offenses. That means that our task force generates about 40 to 45% of all of the felony prosecutions in Dakota County on an annual basis. That's a significant number and would be adversely, and our public safety and our community would be adversely affected if this money or if these cases didn't come in to our offices through a fully funded task force. In addition to that, we seized over $800,000 in street value of cocaine, methamphetamine, and marijuana, just those three drugs last year in our community. As I mentioned, the other types of crimes that are come out of these investigations include domestic violence, forgery, theft, robbery, burglary, crimes that illegal drug users commonly are involved in as the result of the activities that they're doing to finance their involvement in the drug trade. Other cases, child endangerment, assault, other types of offenses that are uncovered through this important work. I also would like to just emphasize the importance of training of the law enforcement officers that are involved in these drug task forces and indicate to you that the county attorneys in our state are committed to working with our task forces to provide the best training we possibly can, and we also need to train our own prosecutors in these issues, and I'd encourage you to keep that in mind as we go forward as well. I know you've already heard a lot of information. I had some more to share with you, but I just wanted to offer our strong support for the continued funding of these task forces. They are essential to the public safety of our community, so thank you for allowing me to be here.
Thank you very much, Mr. Backstrom. And Representative Kelly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess that kind of goes to my previous question. It seems pretty clear that where the task forces are focused, there is a need, and it has positive results. So, but you know, having 24, can all 24 task forces have the same result if the focus and the crime isn't there? It's clear that in this map, we probably have the problem. So, can we have a focus of, I don't know what the number is either, Sheriff, but it would be interesting to see if all the task forces have such great results, and maybe you could comment on having a focus where the crime is.
Sure.
Mr. Chair, members, and Representative Kelly, I think OJP, Department of Public Safety, does have, we publish an annual report, I think that's available to this committee, they may have it here today, that lists out the different task forces across the state, the amount of funding they receive from the state of Minnesota, and their year-end statistics in terms of numbers of arrests, charges, tonnage maybe my county, but numbers or pounds of marijuana or meth or cocaine that is seized, and I encourage you to ask for that and take a look at it. I think you'd be surprised both in terms of your local jurisdictions, but also across the state of Minnesota, what an impact this is having on violent crime.
Thank you. Okay, if there's no other questions, I sure thank you folks much for your presentation and appreciate you coming here and informing us. And if there are cuts, we'll try to take into account everything that you said here today and realize the important mission that you accomplished. So.
Chair members, thank you.
Thank you. Mrs. Bourvier, I could see you were getting nervous, not worrying about not having enough time in front of us here. Welcome to the committee. And
thank you, Mr.
I think
Chair.
You had, so if you want to give your name and title and opening remarks, and we'll start.
Mr. Chair, members, my name is Jerry Bovier, and I'm the Director of the Office of Justice Programs. I appreciate this opportunity this morning to just give you a little oversight. I'm glad that Task Force has got an opportunity to explain how crucial they were to public safety. But I'd like to just take an opportunity to talk about the other programs that are before you and how important they are as well to maintaining public safety. I'd like to give you just a little bit of history on why each program ended up in OJP and were placed there by previous legislative bodies. Overall, I think legislators recognize that public safety is best served when multiple approaches to improving public safety are supported and then connected. OJP's array of programming represents the key stakeholders required to maintain public safety. Public and private service agencies who support victims of crime, young people and families and communities, the police, prosecutors, defense, courts, and corrections, each component as crucial as the next. While no one can truly explain the dramatic reduction in crime over the last years, I am convinced it's due to the balanced support of the multiple strategies across disciplines all working together to improve public safety. In the prevention arena, the legislature approved the passage of the YIP program, the Youth Intervention Program, in 1976 to keep youth out of the juvenile justice system. The purpose was to establish ongoing basis of support for youth intervention services across the state. They wisely required a $2 community match for every dollar of state funding. The legislature recognized that there was nothing soft about turning around the lives of young people and preventing them from entering the costly criminal justice system, when the average cost to society for one youth who quits school and takes up a life of crime was estimated in a Vanderbilt study as $2 million. The justice grants, or the community grants that are also before this committee, were established by the legislature in 1989 to target specific high-risk youth and also to support emerging approaches to reducing crime, like crime prevention through environmental design, police community partnerships, and other community engagement programs that included the populations most affected by crime and violence. There have been many studies that support the cost of effectiveness of proven prevention programming. I believe Scott Beatty presented to this body the social return on investment, a study that was done by Wilder and the university, that indicated that there was a return on investment of $4.89 for every dollar invested. The Office of Justice Programs has conducted many public surveys and planning processes over the years, the most recent in 2010. In every one of these efforts, participants rank prevention and intervention services as their first priority for funding, regardless of the background or position of the participant. In the crime victims arena, the Crime Victim Reparations Board was established by the legislature in 1974. The purpose was to indemnify the victims of violent crime in the state. The original policy intent and philosophy, according to Chairman Dr. William Kosiak, who himself was a victim of crime, he stated, "The victim, without benefits of the statute, is left with nothing except his bills, the worry of his family, as well as the disruption of his household. As a practical matter, now a victim in the state of Minnesota knows that his government is concerned and about him, not just the offender. There has been some experience to indicate that victims of crime who formerly might be unwilling and uncooperative with law enforcement agencies to arrest the perpetrators is now becoming more willing and cooperative. The state legislature expanded support for victims programs in 1977 by creating a program for battered women shelters, and then funding for victims of child abuse, general crime, and sexual violence. In 1985, the legislature passed the first law providing comprehensive crime victim rights, including notification and participation in the criminal justice system. They also created the Office of Crime Victim Ombudsman, which is now the Crime Victim Justice Unit in OJP, designed to investigate violations of crime victim rights and provide assistance in navigating the criminal justice system. There have been many other legislative enhancements to victim rights and additional funding provided over the ensuing years, including the creation of the Emergency Grant Program, funding for the Victim Information Notification Every Day, or VINE system, which provides real-time information to victims of the custody status of the offender, a pilot program to support the development of a comprehensive collaborative model in Ramsey County, to address the problems of domestic violence, which resulted in the blueprint, and the blueprint has garnered national attention and is being implemented in many communities across the state. We have learned much about crime victim services since Dr. Koziak's conjecture in 74. Studies have proven that victims who receive services are much more likely to cooperate with prosecution, and cooperation is essential to successful completion of a case. Crime victim services can prevent further harm by connecting victims to critical and often life-saving services, such as providing shelter, assisting with getting an order for protection, and providing information on what to do if one becomes a victim of identity theft, getting needed counseling for a child witness of violence to stop that cycle of violence. I'll close with kind of what I started with. I'm convinced that we've reduced crime and will continue to reduce crime by employing a balanced, multifaceted approach that builds strong connections among and between prevention, intervention, crime victim service providers, law enforcement, courts, corrections, and communities. We are really proud of the work that our partners do in the field, and we have very high standards for them given that they are expending precious resources. We require their strategies are supported by best practices and research. They provide timely and regular progress in financial reports. We monitor through telephone contact, site visits, desk reviews. We require individual evaluation plans and engage in special assessments. And this last year, we have completed a review of all the violent crime enforcement teams to ensure that they're compliant with the new legislation. And we have completed a comprehensive best practices for crime victims process where our staff worked with the field to develop best practices guidelines, and then staff worked with each program to assess all aspects of their operations. I'm happy to answer any questions about these programs or any other programs you have, Mr. Chair.
Okay, thank you. Representative Leidiger.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ma'am, how big of a department is yours? How many FTEs do you have, please?
Mr. Chair?
Ms. Bovia, go ahead.
Representative, 40.7 FTEs.
Okay.
Mr. Leidiger.
I just have a couple. Where are you located? Is it all in one area?
Mr. Chair, Representative, yes, we are located in Town Square with Arrest of Public Safety.
With Arrest of Public Safety. Do you do the, Mr. Chairman, may I ask a couple others then?
Yeah.
The grant writing for federal dollars, is that what your department does as well? And it's for various programs, I see. It's not just the task forces, it's the juvenile and things like that.
And would you pronounce your last name?
Boisvert.
Boisvert.
Oui.
I don't want to keep butchering your name here. All right. Boisvert, go ahead.
Director.
Mr. Chair, Representative, we do make applications for a variety of federal programs where the state passed through agency for about 15 awards.
Representative Leidiger?
Yes. I want to go back to the numbers here. And I must just have this totally wrong, but in the book it has 16 people or 15 people. Is there another page somewhere that discusses the OGP? Does anybody know? 106 also?
What was your question, Representative Leidiger?
Well, sir, I'm a little confused because I'm looking at the Office of Justice Programs in the book, the budget book. I just see the 16 people, but I understand there's another section.
Mr. Chair, page 94, or do you have 106?
All right. I'll relinquish any additional questions until I read this section.
Okay. Ms. Boisvert, what do you consider your job at the OJP? Is it advocate or administrator or both? Do you get as far as when you come in front of us? Are you basically a transmitter of information, or do you advocate for any of the programs? Or?
Mr. Chair, we're obviously a part of the executive branch, and we take very seriously our job as stewards of the taxpayers' dollars in supporting grant programs in the community.
In the oversight that you give, do you make decisions when the grant applications come through about duplicity, if you see one program doing the same thing as another program, and take that into account?
Mr. Chair, yes, we do.
Representative Smith.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. Ms. Bevere, I'm looking at the updated report that you provided the committee, Domestic Violence Shelter Usage in Minnesota, January 2011. And I'm also went back into my files and found the same report from November 2002, so that's roughly 8 years apart. Excuse me. Looking at, I don't see a page number, but under the Domestic Violence Shelter Executive Director salaries, I see a current salary January of this year, and I'm just looking at three specifically. The Alexandra House, $99,725 salary. 8 years ago, that was $72,000. The Casa de Esperanza, $98,342 is paid to the executive director this year. 8 years ago, it was $78,000, $20,000 less. And then looking at the Sojourner Project, $74,395 is paid to the executive director. 8 years ago, that was $50,000. So that's about a 50% increase in salary. Does your office have any oversight or input into the salary raises of these places?
Ms. Bovier?
Mr. Chair, Representative, we do not make those decisions. Local boards makes those decisions. What we want to make sure is that the dollars are that we put out are it's a reasonable expenditure. That would be the extent to which we would have input.
Mr. Chairman, Ms. Bovier, looking at Appendix 1, which lists the domestic violence shelter assets, and you've got a chart indicating the agency's name, the agency's budget, the shelter budget, and the assets available. I'm looking at a number of these. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 seem to have in excess of a full year's operating budget. The state doesn't have that much. Cities in my house district do not have that much. For example, the Central Minnesota Task Force on Battered Women, Stearns County, their shelter budget is $925,000, yet they have an asset available or a reserve fund of $1,550,000. What is any of those? Are any of those funds earmarked? It looks to be excessive when they have more than a year. Can you talk about that,
Director Bovier?
Mr. Chair, Representative, this is a very difficult chart to put together. And what we do know about a lot of the programs is the shelter is one of the businesses that they operate. I'm not exactly sure what Central Minnesota, the other services that they do, but I do know they provide children's programming that we do not support. They have a variety of other kinds of activities in the community that our shelter budgets do not support. So I know that a lot of the organizations fundraise to provide additional services that they need above and beyond our budgets.
Well,
Smith?
Mr. Chairman, excuse me, thank you. Ms. Bovier, look at that chart beginning with Alexandra House, going to another page, Women's Shelter Olmsted. Added up, the total operating costs that those shelters have in reserve exceeds $20,500,000. So can you pick one that you do know about and talk about their reserve fund?
Ms. Bovier?
Mr. Chair, I'm probably most familiar with Cornerstone, and I do know that the additional funds that they have raised has been specifically for prevention, children's prevention programs, and mental health programming for their children's program, which we don't support at all. I'm probably most familiar with that. There are other organizations like Missions, Inc., where the shelter is one of their operations. They also have a nursing home, a detox center, a residential facility for homeless folks that is part of that larger budget. And the reserves may be targeted by their board for other activities.
Representative Smith?
Mr. Chairman, am I correct, Ms. Bovier, on the Missions, Inc. that you just talked about, that their yearly budget is $1.2 million, but they have a reserve fund of over $5.33 million?
Ms. Bovier?
Mr. Chair, that is correct, but it's also for the nursing home, the detox facility, their GRH facility, and a number of other services. The agency is much larger than just the shelter.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, so their agency budget would include, that column would include what you're talking about, and that would be the $4.5 million. So they actually have roughly $800,000 or $900,000 in excess of what they need per year.
Ms. Bovier?
Mr. Chair, I'm not sure they would consider it in excess of what they need. It depends on if they have needs like a replacement of a roof or other capital expenses that they are required to do. I can't really speak to their budget specifically or their assets.
Well, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Smith.
Two other areas of questions. I don't want to go through the entire list of state-funded grants, but I have two or three questions on it. I see a number of grants to over two or three dozen county attorneys' offices. For example, Meeker County Attorney, $44,225. Several counties receiving $43,145. Can you talk about what those counties, some of those funds or grant amounts are equal in size? Can you talk about what those awards are used for by those counties?
Director Bovier.
Mr. Chair, Representative, those are for crime victim witness programs in those counties. And the history of this funding, that amount was kind of designated to be the core funding for these kinds of programs.
Ms. Bovier, why can't those counties' residents and taxpayers pay that?
Ms. Bovier.
Mr. Chair, I'm not sure if they would assume responsibility for those services, especially given some of the cuts they've received to their budgets.
Mr. Chairman, Ms. Bovier, I see one grant in the amount of $55,855 to the Immigrant Law Center of Minnesota. What is the talk about that grant?
Ms. Bovier.
Mr. Chair, I'm not specifically informed on all that they do, but I know that they provide immigrant services to victims of crime. But I can certainly get you a lot more information in their report.
Ms. Bovier, while Representative Smith is looking through those documents, what do you mean when you say you're not specifically informed of what they do? That worries me a little bit, because are you the decision maker whether they get the grants or not?
Mr. Chair, we have hundreds of grants, and we have grant managers who are responsible for understanding the details of their caseload. And I can certainly get that information for you, but I am not completely aware of all individual grantees' activities. I can certainly provide them to you.
Describe the process when an application comes in to you. Who decides whether they get it? Is it the grant manager or you? Is there a team? And how in depth do you look at this? Naturally, high salaries and reserve balances worry us here, and also when you've got one heading, but then say the organization spends it on this, 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 and this, that causes some speculation too. So who are the decision makers, and what do they all look at? Do they look at all these other headings or just the main heading it's under?
Mr. Chair, there are different processes for different grant types. For the crime victim grants, about 6 years ago, there was a process where a formula was created based on crime rate, population, geographic distances, and funds. A large amount of funds were allocated to judicial districts. The people in that district got together and determined how to meet the needs of that district in crime victim services. And that's been the basis of the funding. But we do review their applications to ensure that their budgets are sound. And those are kind of on a formula. The others are competitive. The applications come in. We convene a body of experts in that area to review and rank those proposals. We then have a second level of review, and grant managers let us know if they've had difficulty with certain grantees in the past. But generally, the decisions are made by an external committee.
The funding that Representative Smith is talking about, mm-hmm. the reserve balances, how long are they able to carry those, and do they carry them forward into the next, are they allowed to carry them into the next biennium?
Mr. Chair, it depends. We have not. We were asked last year to look at reserves very closely to figure out who had them and what they were for, and we did gather this information. Depending on the organization and depending on their assets and what the board has designated them for, they may not or they can carry them forward. They're really, the decision is made by the board that governs that entity.
Naturally, what Ms. Bovier, what we worry about in state government is the comes up a lot is the carry forward or the spending down or spending so that you get the same amount next year. So these high balances naturally bring a lot of attention. Representative Smith, did you have another question?
Mr. Chairman, yes, thank you, I do. Ms. Bovier, a couple more questions on the several pages of these specific grants. I see one to the Civil Society for $1,000. Comparatively, that looks like a chintzy award. What was that for, and frankly, what is the Civil Society, and what did they use that $1,000 for?
Ms. Bovier.
Mr. Chair, Representative, that would be part of the emergency grant program. We have 75 organizations that get between $1,000 and $5,000 to provide emergency funding for an example, a victim whose locks are broken and need to be replaced. So Civil Society was, in fact, one of those organizations that had access to those emergency funds.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Ms. Bovier, what are the qualifications that you have to adhere to get your locks fixed free? I'd like to know if I can apply.
Ms. Bovier.
Mr. Chair, we do have, and Representative, we do have a set of guidance for all the programs to operate, and I'm happy to provide it for you.
Very good. Mr. Chairman, Ms. Bovier, I see a grant of $375,000 and some dollars to the Mille Lacs Band of Ojibwe, an additional grant of $182,000 to the American Indian Community. With specifically with regard to the Mille Lacs Band of Ojibwe, $375,000. What was that grant for? Go ahead on that.
Mr. Chair, Director Representative, Bolger. That's for a shelter, at a women's shelter.
Ms. Bovier, that particular band has access to income from two casinos.
Ms. Bovier.
Would it be more appropriate to let them fund their own shelter?
Ms. Bovier.
Mr. Chair, we provide funding and services to the entire state of Minnesota.
That, Mr. Chairman, that wasn't an answer to my question.
Ms. Bovier.
Mr. Chair, I have a personal opinion about that, but in terms of having a business support its own projects in its community, maybe that's appropriate for all communities, or maybe it's appropriate for none.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Smith.
One other chart, Ms. Bovier, lists state criminal alien assistance programs. I'm not going to read all of them, but they total just under $2 million. And they go either to the state of Minnesota, $956,000, and then some to several counties for as little as $3,800 and for as much as $294,000, depending on which county. What is the State Criminal Alien Assistance Program?
Mr. Chair?
Director Bovier.
Representative, it's a federal program. Those funds are go directly, that's not administered by OJP. They go directly from the feds to the Department of Corrections and to local jails to offset the costs of housing illegal immigrants.
So, Ms. Chairman, Ms. Bovier,
that
$2 million is not state money. It's federal
Mr.
money.
Mr. Chair and Representative, that's correct.
Mr. Chair, Ms. Bovier, And maybe restate your answer. This, the $2 million goes specifically to illegal, to assist illegal immigrants, illegal aliens?
Mr. Chair, Representative, it goes to correctional facilities to assist them with the cost of housing offenders who are illegal immigrants.
Mr. Chairman, Ms. Bevere, of the $2 million to assist in the, quote, housing, in other words, in jail.
Correct.
Do you know what the total cost beyond the $2 million is, if that's only our award? Do you know, or do you, what the total cost is to house illegal aliens in the state of Minnesota?
Mr. Chair, I do not.
Mr. Chairman, thank you.
Did Representative Muller in the list yet or not? I seen a name tag. I didn't know if it was in this order or... Are you on the list to talk or not?
No, Mr. Chairman, when Representative Smith, he asked what civil society was, I was just going to say he carried a bill for them last week.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Mowry, just seeing if you're a list. Thank you.
Representative Leidiger.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Smith pretty much asked the same kinds of questions, but I want to follow up then on the last one, the State Criminal Alien Assistant Program. Is that an amount of money? It's almost $2 million to aid these aliens that are in prison. Is this some a rising figure? Is this something that we've had coming into the state for years? And can you tell me at what rate of increase that's happening, or decrease, or is it staying steady? Could you address that, please?
Mr. Chair.
Ms. Bevere.
Representative, this is a federal fund that's been available, I think, for the last decade.
Okay.
We don't administer the fund, so I'm not completely familiar with it. I do know that in both the federal fiscal year 11 and federal fiscal year 12 budget, it is recommended to be zeroed out.
Representative Kelly.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And maybe a follow-up, and I know, Director Bevere, you said you had a personal opinion on this issue of the award to Mille Lacs Man of Ojibwe at $375,000. But to me, it goes to the to how we decide where these grants are going to, the process. What kind of criteria then do we look at? Don't we look at maybe ability to have other funds or to be funded from other sources? I understand not discriminating across the state for where there's need, but it seems like other issues must come into play. So how did that one go through the process and say there's no other funds for this?
Director Bevere.
Mr. Chair, Representative, it was part of the overall application process. They established need for these services in their community and established a reasonable budget to support these services, and the decision was made to support them because there had been really quite a dearth of services actually for Native women across the state. We do look at other resources. It's generally other funds that people are able to get from nonprofit entities or their community. But this would also hold true if we were looking at a large business in a community supporting a crime victims program in their community as well.
Mr. Chair,
Billy?
Then would one of the criteria possibly be matching funds or their ability to put other dollars towards the programs, whether it's this one or other ones across the state?
Director Bevere.
Mr. Chair, there is a match requirement, but we do know that we don't come close to funding the entire operation, as in the task forces of all these programs. These dollars leverage significant volunteer effort as well as local donations.
Thank you.
And Representative Gauthier.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Director Bevere, is there who licenses battered shelters in the state?
Mr. Chair.
Director Bevere.
They are subject to the codes and the enforcement of the local community.
So it would be county, probably. And then... kind of a comment to Representative Smith, if there's an agency that involves chemical dependency like a detox, they're required to have 1/4's worth of operating funds in reserves under DHS. So if it was a $4 million program, they'd have to have a $1 million program. And Ms. Beauvais, or Director Beauvais, when we're looking at tribal programs, do we treat those like county entities for purposes of funding like DHS does?
Director Beauvais.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I would say we treat them more like kind of a combination of county and nonprofit.
Okay. Mr. Chair, Director Beauvais, so whether or not we funded a tribal program, we may be funding that program under a county program or a city program, but the tribal government happens to be the entity involved. Is that correct?
Director Beauvais.
Mr. Chair, Representative, that is correct.
Director, so because they're citizens of Minnesota, they'd be entitled to those services, and it has nothing to do with other business entities that that government may have, correct?
Director Beauvais.
Mr. Chair, Representative, that is correct.
Thank you.
Representative Smith, to that point.
Mr. Chairman, it's not on that point.
Oh, okay.
Sorry.
You okay if we go to McDonald first and then you?
Sure.
Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Beauvais, question for you. You mentioned earlier in your statement that under the OJP, you fund some issues such as mental health issues, homeless assistance, nursing homes, and detox facilities. Of course, I'm the new guy here, and I also sit on the Health and Human Services Reform and Finance, and we spend hundreds of millions of dollars on those programs and that under DHS. Would this be in addition to that?
Director Beauvais.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I was just trying to clarify the type of organizations in this case that Mission Inc. was. It had all those other types of activities. We just funded the battered women's shelter, but they do have all these other DHS facilities. So it was not saying we fund a variety of those. It's just talking about some of the businesses that are provide crime victim services.
Representative McDonald.
Very good. So they do not overlap, then. We're not funding the same symptoms, the same problems on two different fronts. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, that is correct.
All right. And then, Mr. Chair, and of course, you're aware of the document we have in front of us here. It goes through all the grants. And my understanding with grants, being involved in city politics for 10 years, is you have to kind of, obviously there's a board that oversees all these grants. Is that correct?
Director Beauvais.
Mr. Chair, there is advisory committees for some, and there is not a board for others.
Representative McDonald?
Mr. Chair, and then you said earlier, according to, I think Representative Smith asked you, these funds should be depleted and granted to a lot of these grants in order to be refunded again for the next year. Is that correct?
Director Beauvais.
Mr. Chair, Representative, in reference to the assets, no, I didn't say that they need to be depleted.
All right. anyway, very good, Mr. Chair. One more question. Just regarding, I'm looking at all the different grants here, and there is one here in particular that I think was mentioned under the U of M office-sponsored projects, close to $800,000 for developing a DVD and an online video training tool for supervised visitation of safe exchange services. And that jumps out to me just because this is something that we do in my business, and that certainly is a large number. So $800,000 for a DVD and an online video. I'm curious as to if you could explain or just give me a little enlightenment on that.
Director Beauvais.
Mr. Chair, Representative, this list is a bit deceptive because it's money that came directly from the feds to organizations and from us as well. That particular grant came directly from the federal government to the University of Minnesota, and we do not administer that program.
Representative McDonald?
Well, I still would like to know a little bit about that. Even if we're getting money from the federal government, I'd like to have a little more information on that and have be responsible for how that money is spent. It is out of one pocket to the other.
Mr. Chair, it does not come through the Office of Justice Programs. It just goes directly to them. We do not administer it in any way, that particular program.
So the list that no responsibility of it whatsoever?
We do not.
I see. And who oversees that grant then?
Representative McDonald?
Oh, I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Chair, Representative, the appropriate federal office that gave the grant, and in this case, I think it might have been the Office of Victims of Crime, I think.
Representative McDonald.
Okay, very good. Thank you.
Before I get to Representative Smith, State Criminal Alien Assistance Program used for housing illegal aliens in the country. What isn't that just a spit in the bucket compared to how many there are here? We had costs of Mr. Carter, you had given me a study once before. What was the total figure of that?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I think it was from a partial fiscal note, and I think in the state prison system there are over 400 illegal aliens, and I estimated the cost to be over $20 million a year.
It was nice of the feds to give us back one-tenth of it anyway. The other thing is the County Attorneys Association here has... Does anybody come down? There we go, Mr. Brown. I think you wanted to comment about something else, but while you're here, tell us why we're funding county attorneys for what would appear to be normal workload on the grant program.
Mr. Chair,
got to grill you a little bit.
Members of the committee, I'm David Brown. I'm an assistant Hennepin County attorney. I saw Mr. Backstrom running out of the building, and
yeah.
So I'll step in here. And it really goes, Mr. Chair, also to Representative Smith's question. What I wanted to respond to is why the legislature has funded victim witness programs in the county attorney's offices. As you are all probably aware, Minnesota Statute 611A contains a number of state mandates for prosecutors to be involved with victims. It requires prosecutors to advise victims if there's going to be a plea agreement. As they should. But the state statute mandates that prosecutors advise victims if there's going to be a recommendation that the defendant participate in pretrial diversion, which is a good thing. The victim should know that. That's a very cost-effective way of dealing with these cases, but the state has mandated that prosecutors make that advice. What you see, particularly in the Hennepin, and 611A has a number of other mandates like that from the state to the county prosecutor. And my belief is that this was a recognition that they were going to partially fund those state mandates. Obviously, our victim witness people do an enormous amount more than just what is mandated. We have our victim witness people with our child abuse victims preparing them for court. Talking to our corporations who've had thefts from them. They're calling all the time. How do we get restitution? How do we file that paperwork? And those are somebody on the phone answering those calls. It takes an enormous amount of their time. We have a number of victim witness people in Hennepin County, and the grant that you see here would fund a fraction of one of them. But I think it was a recognition by the legislature for the county attorney's offices that if they were going to mandate victim notifications, there would be some funding by the state. And how each county handles that, I can't tell you. For Hennepin County, that's a fraction of what the county spends on victim witness service.
Just a comment. It's funny that we have to mandate that laws are enforced, and if we do, I don't necessarily think that it should bring money with it for it, but it seems like a certain amount of county attorney workload would just be generated. Another hot question. Oh, Representative Smith, I wanted to get you on board here before you have to go to another committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Bevere, a couple questions. Back on the page dealing listing the assets available or the operating funds, it was pointed out from the committee table that if an entity provides chemical dependency counseling, that they're required to keep at least one-fourth of their operating budget as a assets available. I don't know that to be the case, but assuming that it is, how many of these shelters listed showing available assets are mandated or required by statute, either federal or state, to have a certain level of assets available? Are there any on this list, and which ones are they?
Director Bolger.
Mr. Chair, Representative, if anybody gets any, receives any federal funding, there is an expectation that there is adequate depreciation funds for depreciated costs held in abeyance. I think there's only one program here who has a chemical dependency program, but I think there is best practices outlined by all funders that to have a reasonable amount of assets to maintain programming.
Mr. Chairman, so the answer is the federal government expects all but one to have some assets but doesn't require it. Available assets.
Mr. Chair, I think that is correct.
Thank you. One other question. Minnesota Statute 609.101 Subdivision 2 dealing with surcharge of fines, minimum fines. There's language in Subdivision 2 that's, I'm not going to read all of it, but it says the court shall collect the portion of the fine mandated by the subdivision and forward 70% of it to a local victim assistance program that provides services locally, etc. And it defines victim assistance program to include crime victim crisis centers, victim witness programs, battered women shelters, non-shelter programs, sexual assault programs. Do you or your agency receive or supervise any of those mandated fines?
Director Bovier?
Surcharges, excuse me.
Mr. Chair, Representative, we do not.
Do you have an idea, Mr. Chairman, Ms. Bovier, do you have an idea how much money that is? It seems to be money in addition to what your agency is receiving from the state, that by statute additional sums are going to battered women shelters. Do you have any idea how much that is?
Director Bovier.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I'm sorry, I do not.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I'd like to ask why you don't, but I guess I won't.
Mr. Brown, did you have anything further for us?
Nothing.
Okay, you're really sorry.
Mr. Chair, thank you so much.
Okay. Prosecutor, Mr. Brown, sorry about that. We had a question here that I had for you. Let you go so easy here. This is a tough one. We have... question is violent crime has gone down significantly, allegedly, here with the statistics we've seen, and we're wondering if that's had the effect on the county attorneys across the state, if you've been able to reduce staff because of it.
Well, Mr. Chair, we've had to reduce staff whether or not there was a reduction in violent crime. Our count, we have left a number of positions unfilled for quite some time. So in terms of caseloads per prosecutor, we have not seen that same level of decrease, partly because we're holding positions open due to budget cuts. Certainly the decrease in violent crime has helped with that. It hasn't made it quite as bad. But
okay, thank you. Appreciate it. Ms. Bovier, looking at this list, you can see why there's great consternation today. And I wish we would have brought more people to the table so you could answer more questions specifically, because we did give you some advance notice. I wish that some of these people that represent these could have showed up. There are just too many questions with too few of answers and too much money going through the door here that's going to cause a lot of speculation, especially this year. And I'm sure you've had forewarning by now from the questions that a number of these, if not all, are going to receive heavy speculation and probably some cuts. And so between now and next week when we start to put the bill together, we might have a number of other questions for you on some of these and why they're being funded, the salaries, the reserves, the things like this. There are really, you know, deeply concerned a number of our committee members here. And Representative Grunhagen.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a comment. You know, one of my convictions coming in as a freshman in the legislature here is that wherever government subsidy shows up, the price of everything goes up, okay? And that's just because human nature and a number of other factors. So you know, just a comment is, when I look at this, and especially Representatives Smith's line of questioning, but first I should say, I believe this is a need that needs to be met, okay? I think the goal here of helping people in this situation is laudable and needs to be done, but I question whether government subsidies produce the most effective way to do it at the best cost. And what I mean by that is, and I'm just throwing this out for food for thought, I think that reducing the government subsidies while over like a 3 to 5 year period of time and increasing tax credits, not tax deductions, but tax credits for individuals to contribute to these organizations would, number one, bring the overall cost down. Number two, individuals and corporations would give to those organizations that are producing the best result at the most cost-effective way. And what I'll just throw out a suggestion, a tax credit of about $10,000, up to $10,000 for individuals, a tax credit to up to $50,000 for corporations. And I think you'd see, you know, we have a very generous a state here, both corporate and individuals, and I think to the degree that the state can get themselves out of the subsidy business and incentivize a tax credit to have people fill this need, we'd see a much more cost-effective and efficient system, and then we would reward those organizations that are actually doing an effective job. Otherwise, we simply sit in a situation here where we contest salaries and benefits and the organization, and this just goes on and on and on and on. And to the degree that that has merit, I'll leave it to the committee and others to sort through, but it's just an observation that I have. Thank you, Ms. Chair. We need to change the structure of how we're doing this, is my point.
The Director Bovier, the funding of 400,000 OJP funding that goes to support the federal task force Safe Streets, this money goes to the Minneapolis-St. Paul Police Department, but doesn't that defeat the intent of the state dollars going to local law enforcement? Why shouldn't the feds fund their own task force?
Mr. Chair, I think the sheriff and the chief explain what these dollars allow them to do is to stay engaged in a multi-jurisdictional effort to address crime that crosses multi-jurisdictional boundaries, as their local budgets would not allow them to engage in that. I think that was clearly what they were saying when they were up here.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to say that not everyone shares your consternation about these programs and the funding thereof. I think you know, public safety is a core function of government that we need to fund as fully as possible. And as we've heard from testimony, these programs, in fact, provide a lot in terms of crime prevention and services to victims and a variety of people that are in need. So this is something we need to take a look at real hard. Again, public safety is a core government service, is something we should be funding, and to be cutting these kinds of services is something we should be taking lightly.
So, Representative Johnson, you're not concerned about a single one of these programs and the $1 million in reserves and the unaccountability, the unanswered questions? You're unconcerned about that? You said you didn't have any, didn't share any concerns. Do you share at least one?
Mr. Chair, I didn't say concerns. I said consternation. I think there's a different attitude towards what we're talking about here in terms of the services provided by these organizations. I think they provide a valuable service. Certainly, we need to look at their operational functions and the like, but to start with the assumption that they're not providing an important core government function, I think, is incorrect.
Well, I sure hope you get some consternation before next week. All right, Representative Kiefer.
Okay. Thank you. And I, too, appreciate the ultimate service that these organizations provide. I'm kind of crunching numbers here, and I'm looking, and I'd like to just give a shout out to a couple organizations that look like they're doing it right and very efficiently. As Tubman and Women's Advocates, according to the numbers that I have, and I'm not saying these are accurate. I have no idea where these sources are coming from, but it's probably on the web somewhere. But Women's Advocate is 5% for their executive director salaries and 3% for Tubman. And those are quite a bit lower than most of the other organizations. And they're also serving a higher number of, I'm assuming, women and children. And so I would just suggest that we look at these organizations and say, what are you guys doing right? How can we follow your model and streamline? And then there's a couple other ones that are much higher with their executive director salary compared to their budget, and that's Casa de Esperanza, which, according to our page one, only serves about 12 people. Their capacity is quite high. But then the Violence Intervention Project has got 8 people, and their executive salary percentage is at about 23% of the budget, which seems high, really high. And if we're going to, and I agree that getting more donations from people, and I support organizations like this myself personally, that's really important. But I think people are more tempted to give money to organizations that they know the donations are going to go to the people it's supposed to help and not to an executive director's salary as well. So I would just ask that we look at which programs are effective and which ones maybe need some help. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, if I might comment, we do provide, I appreciate your comments, we also do provide, maybe our grantees would say, too much oversight in terms of determining their effectiveness or working with them to have legitimate outcomes. We work really hard to ensure that all of the programs on that list have an evaluation plan and are assessed to be providing quality services. If they don't, the grants are terminated. And we have done that in the past, and we'll do it in the future.
We've got Representative Gauthier and then Representative Kelly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Director Bourbet, quite clearly there's a lot of concern about people having budget reserves and whatnot. And I'm wondering if it's possible for your agency to request from them why they have those reserves. Are they mandated? Is it just good business sense? What is it? Because I do believe that, when I was applying for grants, we had to demonstrate that we were fiscally sound and we weren't getting them. And maybe that would help in making some good decisions next week, if we could have some of that information. I think there's some legitimate concerns. I think there's some reasons why people have reserves. And just to speculate that they're hoarding money or whatever, I don't know if that's true. Maybe some of them are. But I think some of them are required by mandates. So I think that would be helpful to the committee if you could do that for us. Is that possible?
Mr. Chair, Representative, we do have some of that information now, and we could provide more detail.
Thank you.
And Representative Kelly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Director. Just curious in process, is there a level of grant that requires less authorization, or maybe if you get to $50,000, it has to go to another level, or are there different levels so that maybe at that you would have to get to, maybe then it's a full-blown board or yourself involved. Just process.
Director Baldwin.
Mr. Chair, Representative, we do have, in terms of the size of the grants or the processes, those are fairly similar, and we do review applications completely, whether it's a $25,000 grant or a $2 million grant. And we do have boards involved in some cases or independent bodies, and ultimately it's the Commissioner of Public Safety who makes the final call. But we do provide or do gather as much input as we can in terms of developing the request for proposal and then the review of the proposal and then what kind of data should be gathered to judge success of that program from the field and from experts. I hope that answers your question.
Representative Kelly?
Mr. Chair, it does, but I was just curious. I mean, we certainly aren't taking as much time on a $1,000 grant as we are a $1 million grant. So I was just wondering if there's a breakout that says, okay, here's level of grants, or maybe there's $51,000 grants that can go through this process, and then we have a much more intense process for something like $1 million grant.
Mr. Chair, Representative, we do have a different monitoring protocol for smaller grants. In terms of intensity, that does step up. depending on the size of the grant.
Okay. Thank you.
Director Bovier, how frequently are the assessments done, and what are your measurements, basically? Now, do you do one at the type of the application and granting of the application, but are there any other checks and balances during the biennium, or how long that money is applied to you?
Mr. Chair, all grantees provide, obviously, needs data up front, or in the case of the drug task forces, they do a threat assessment of their area. Everyone is required to do either a quarterly or a semi-annual report to report progress. There is constant contact between the grant manager and the grantee over the phone. When those reports come in, they're reviewed, and feedback is given to the grantee regarding the progress they are making. And in addition, there are site visits where staff go actually out and watch the program in process. And then we do desk reviews, which is a surprise. You send in a request for reimbursement, and then we ask grantees to provide us with the supporting documentation that supports that request. So we have a variety of oversight throughout the year for each grant.
Okay. Representative Gauthier.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just for clarification purposes, some issues have been made about directors' salaries or program directors' salaries. When somebody's submitting a grant, but at least when I was writing them, that was just standard practice that you list those things. That didn't mean you were funding those things. Oftentimes, a percentage of my salary was, if I was giving 5 hours out of 40 for the week, that's what went in the grant, was the request for that 5 hours. Is that the practice that the Office of Justice does? And can you explain that so the committee has a little better idea of what that's all about? Because I think it's an unfair comparison to say this is 28% of the grant, because that's not the whole program, and it's not the whole funding source.
Director Bovier, that's a very good question. And when you answer that, could you maybe also answer it as far as how many of these programs are totally funded by the grant, and how many survive, and kind of what percentage? There are some that are totally funded, so they would use the whole salary, or are some that are partially funded, so the salary would be their own bailiwick?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I think you can look at the shelter budgets on the asset report to show you what their shelter budgets are. We rarely are 100% support of a grant. I can think of one. But, Representative, you're exactly correct. We will find out the director's salary, but in most cases, we certainly do not pay 100% of the director's salary. In fact, we only pay for, or we try to pay for, just direct services with these dollars, the services or a portion of that supervision that director is providing. In some cases, we do pay their full salary, and in some cases, they are providing direct services as well as running a small organization.
Director Bovier, do you have any sense of overall the programs? Has there ever been a percentage that's popped into your mind about how much of their operation you fund overall of Earl? If you had to average it out, how much of their total operating budget the grant is?
Mr. Chair, I'd just be making up a number, no, but I could probably find out something for you if that's helpful.
Okay. Representative Kiefer.
Well, just to that point, I didn't say it was to the grant money, but maybe I'm reading this wrong. It says shelter budget on Appendix 2. So is that a different number? Is shelter budget grant amount? Or is it the budget? I'm learning, too. I'd like to have clarification. Thank you.
Director Bovier.
Mr. Chair, that is correct. It is the shelter budget.
All right. Well, I've run out of questions. Anybody else? Okay. Thank you very much,
you,
Director. We appreciate your appearance here, and we've got your contact information. If there's any specifics we need from you, you know, between now and then, it would be great next week.
I'm happy to provide any further information.
Representative Mullery, we plan on rolling out the first public announcement and spreadsheets next Tuesday of this committee, and somewhere between now and then, I'll get together with you and talk over specifics. So.
I know.
And we'll have hearings long into the night, I'm sure, next week. So if you could have your members not make any plans for the evenings, and in case we have to have impromptu ones, but hopefully they'll be on the schedule, and they could go long depending on how many amendments you have. So
that and every other thing.
All right. And if not, meeting adjourned.